Okay, this is Thursday, January 10th. We're in the conference room at the Archives of Labor and Urban Affairs at Wayne University. And today and tomorrow, on the 11th, we'll be interviewing extensively William Lucy, the Secretary Treasurer of AFSCME. Bill, can we start today at something about your early life, where you were born, your family, names of the family and the like, and siblings, if there were any. And let's go back to the 1930s in Memphis, Tennessee.
All right. I was born in Memphis, Tennessee. One of originally three children. One passed away early. My brother, who was a year older, Joe Lucy, named after my father, Joe Lucy. And my mother, who was Susie Bell Lucy. Parents originally from Alabama. My early years in Memphis, Tennessee was sort of interesting years. This was 1933. I was born in November 26. And of course, you don't know an awful lot about the early days, but those days you remember is when you started your schooling, you started to understand, you know, the city around you. I went to a little school called La Rose Elementary School, which is still in Memphis, Tennessee, by the way, and spent the early years there. We lived in a number of places in Memphis. I thought for some time that we traveled a lot, you know, and then I realized after a while that we were traveling almost in 30-day cycles, 30, 60, and 90. But my father worked as a part-time mechanic, part-time musician, part-time unskilled labor. So in those days, as I understand now, work was not what you call steady. So our movement was related to income. but we lived in many parts of Memphis. Finally, in the years that are most clear to me, we lived at a place called Lemoyne Gardens, which at that time was a housing project developed by the city of Memphis in conjunction with the federal government. We lived quite near what is now Lemoyne Owens College. And it's interesting, in those days, a home in the projects was a rather prestigious place to live. Unlike today, I mean, the projects are now presumed to be some place of poor, downtrodden, what have you. In those days, you had to qualify to be given an apartment in the projects. You had to be a family who could stand the scrutiny of other families in the project. So we lived there for at least some of the early formative years. As I say, I went to a La Rose Elementary School, and we remained in Memphis until shortly after the outbreak of World War II. On December 7th, at the beginning of the war, my parents, like a lot of others, became sort of caught up in the war effort. My father at that time worked for Memphis Power and Light Company as an unskilled laborer, with the emphasis being on unskilled. He, like so many others at that time, had been either helped with a job or given the job by the political leadership of the city, one E.H. Crump. He worked for the Light and Power Company as an unskilled laborer. And I make that point because it challenges the notion that the nation can do what it needs to do in an emergency. As I said, he was an unskilled laborer on December the 7th. On January the 7th, he was a journeyman welder. He and so many of his other friends were brought into the war effort and moved to California to work in the shipyards of Henry Kaiser.
Now, continue in Memphis, by way of background, were your family, when did your parents or your father move to Memphis? Was he from rural areas?
He was from rural Alabama. They moved, as I'm told, just a matter of a few days before I was born. It was quite common, I think, for folks to leave the South and move up, as they say, leave the South in terms of Alabama or Mississippi and move to Memphis. Memphis was sort of the point of opportunity for a lot of workers from rural states. So I guess until about six or seven, that was home for us.
Right.
And at the beginning of the war, when thousands upon thousands were recruited and brought to the centers for the war effort,
right.
My father, along with a number of others, either enlisted, were conscripted, or whatever, to work in the shipyards.
Right.
They were given the basic training necessary in 2 and 3 and 4 week courses to join the workforce. He became a welder. And was sent to work in the shipyards in Richmond, California, which was essentially why we left Memphis, Tennessee and moved to Richmond. We moved in the early part of 1942. That would be my brother, my mother and myself. Caught the train like a lot of other families and joined the breadwinners in the areas of wartime employment. I grew up in Richmond, California. Went to schools all levels. Completed the elementary school in Richmond, California. Went to junior high school and high school. On to junior college. We lived like a lot of other people, again in a project setting, wartime. Richmond, prior to the war effort, had been by and large a farm community. Which became the center of ship construction. Richmond, California was noted for what they called the Victory Ship, which was Henry Kaiser's contribution to the war effort. He promised President Roosevelt and the War Department that he would build one ship every day, and he did, and some of them even floated. But the principal point was that thousands and thousands of workers were brought into that area for essentially 24-hour around-the-clock work, my father being one of them.
What was the makeup of the community when you came there?
Richmond had exploded into a fairly diverse community during the war, although the living patterns were fairly segregated. Wartime workers were given housing through a housing administration, and by and large, the housing patterns were pretty much the same as they would have been in the South, except that the city as a whole was fairly diverse, with some old-time residents. I guess if you dealt with ethnic groups, you'd have the Italian community, some parts of the Irish community, Hispanic communities, but all by and large separated. We grew up in that environment, not at that time paying such great attention to the race questions, because it's a full-time concentration on the war effort. I graduated, as I say, from junior high school and went on to a high school at El Cerrito High School, which is in a little adjoining city, quite close to Richmond. Richmond in those times was an exciting town, I mean, for someone preteen and then teenager. We began to get a sense of what that kind of community could be. I mean, the assumption was at the end of the war in 1945, everybody would go back where they came from, which is not the case at all. Richmond became sort of a bustling community. With the major industries being Standard Oil, Ford Motor Company at that time, some chemical companies, a large segment of the economy was tied to new construction. So it was an area where there were good opportunities for a better life, and our parents stayed there until a few years later. What I began to at least personally understand is that California held the promise of a good life, not just for myself but for others. The education system, while I couldn't evaluate it at that point in time, on reflection, was a tremendous education system for young folks of all races and all colors. And it would prepare you for all kinds of opportunities. I have to applaud our school system. Even though it had its problems, it had the ability to deliver a good quality education to the youngsters who came through it.
Let's stop for a minute about pause about your education. In high school, what interests did you have? What subjects, or even going on further from high school, was sports a part of your interest, for example?
Sports was a part of the interest. I played baseball, basketball, and about three games of varsity football before a bright and promising career came to an end. my principal interest in high school was focused towards architectural drafting. I had thought then that the ability to create and design and what have you was something that was of interest to me. So from junior high school on through high school and on through a bit of junior college, I was focused on architectural drafting, on buildings, on bridges, on homes, and what have you, and sort of prepared for that. And then discovered in those days that the only drafting that an African-American could do would be the printing on designs and drawings that were prepared by someone else. There was no real areas of work opportunities that you could get as a as an architect at that time. But the skills that I learned came invaluable in an engineering context. I graduated from high school in January of 1951, which was a little bit earlier than normal because the normal graduation period was mid-year. But because of the number of classes that I'd been taking and the number of things that had been done, so you acquired the necessary credits to graduate early. And I enrolled at Contra Costa Junior College, again in architectural drafting with an architectural focus, and attended Contra Costa. Then by this time, the Korean War had been going on for a while. And many of the classmates that I have either went into the Army or went into some branch of the service. I, in some sort of a strange piece of luck, wound up going to work for the Navy at Maryland Naval Shipyard, which is located in Vallejo, California. Initially coming in as a laborer in the rigging, we call it the rigging loft, which is the department that dealt with just basic labor support or the handling of materials and what have you for the ships. Shortly after that, got transferred to the engineering section of the yard, which dealt with all of the engineering issues that confront the Navy yard infrastructure, whether that be streets and highways and railroads and water and electricity and what have you. And worked there for a couple of years, from 1951, the tail end of it, till early 53. And again, one of these strokes of luck. I was called by the county of Contra Costa and asked if I would be interested in applying with their Department of Public Works as an engineering aide, which was the entry-level position into the engineering series in that county. And I didn't seem to have anything to lose, so I applied. And then waited for a while, and luckily they called and asked if I want to come in for an interview and take the examination, which I did. And shortly after, they offered a job, and I bid farewell to the U.S. Navy and went to work for Contra Costa County.
This was about 1960.
No, this is about 1953, tail end of 53, early 54.
20 years old.
Right. And I worked for the county for 13 years, from 1953 to 1966, in the Public Works Department, and sort of traversing your way through the department. I started first in the Materials and Testing Laboratory. And in 1953, you may recall, the federal government passed the massive highway construction program, what it's called the Federal Aid to Secondary Highway Construction Project. And all of the states, in order to participate, had to have an engineering component that would be capable of meeting the legislative criteria for financial participation and grants. And the theory, and I guess it was Eisenhower's, was that if we open up the country with decent highways, good highways, in the state system, and support the construction of good farm-to-market roads, as they call them, at the county level, that goods and products would move a lot easier. And our state, the state of California, was just a leading state in the development of its state highway system. And our county, which was a strong industrial county, but at the same time a strong agricultural county, had got into this process. So they were in this early stages of developing a strong public works department with a strong engineering section to meet that criteria. So the laboratory was being set up for the quality control purposes of the legislation. And so I was one of the early members of the materials and testing department. Worked there for about a year, year and a half, and then got transferred into the surveying section of the department, and then got transferred back to the materials and research laboratory that had developed a little bit stronger at that point. Worked there year in, year out, construction projects, highways, bridges, you name it, all of those things that a public works engineering department do. Later on, as they upgraded the criteria for personnel, they created a position called supervising materials tester, which was the person who supervised the activities of the laboratory, both inside the lab and field personnel. And I was, again, lucky. I think, you know, most of my life have been lucky enough to be in the right place, right time. I was granted the position and proceeded to work with the materials engineer to expand the role of the department and develop more testing procedures to train personnel how to use existing procedures for our quality control work and virtually every aspect of highway construction. And I stayed there until 1966. About 54, 55, I became involved in the what was then the County Employee Association, which was an organization that essentially had a sort of a representational role for virtually all of the county employees, not a collective bargaining agent as we would know it, but it lobbied before the Board of Supervisors. It lobbied the civil service commissions and made representation on pension programs and things like that, which was, for that time, a useful function and role. California then, and I think as well as now, had a tremendous civil service system.
Right.
Unlike some of the systems back east where they were so subject to manipulation. I mean, it was a good system. The wages were good. The benefits were fair and decent. But they came out of this concept of trying to get to and maintain the quality personnel. But the shortcoming that it had, that it was the boss's system. It was the it was the political leadership system. It didn't allow for a direct role for employee organizations. And the County Employee Association had for years been quite successful, but it did not have a legitimate right to participate as a representational agent. And in the mid to late 50s, this became a real issue of debate. As I said, our county was a strong industrial county and had a broad agricultural base. And all around us were strong unions working on behalf of their members. And the debate that came to the forefront was, we have a right as public employees to participate in every aspect of what affects our work life, and not just as workers who have the right to complain after something happens, but we have a right to participate before something happens. And this sounded like a fairly simple piece of logic at the time, but what it raised was the issue of collective bargaining in the true sense for public employees in our county. And while some of us may not have known, you know, philosophically what issues we were raising, it certainly became clear in short order that we were saying we have a right to sit at the table and not just talk about these things, but bargain a contractual agreement with the employer that spoke to and spelled out wages, hours, and conditions of employment for all of these people that we represent.
In your job for these 13 years, you indicated that there were advancements, the challenging assignments and the like. I assume the salary was increasing proportionately and the like. Were you and others satisfied in some aspects with your work employment?
I think we were satisfied, and I certainly was. I didn't really see at that time a great need to talk about a union, and I have to confess I didn't have a great understanding of it. The staff at the laboratory were all professional engineers of one grade or level or another, and felt that whatever problems we had, we could get them resolved. And I became the spokesperson for the engineering group in the laboratory, and a couple of other groups whose salaries and benefits were pegged to the same sort of position on the pay scale. We had titles, and then they, in the civil service system, those get locked into other functions of of equal importance. Well, I became the spokesperson for that group, and as such, became involved with the Civil Service Commission in the salary setting process. And that's when I thought I had an education before. That's when I got a real education about how the process works. I served as chairperson of the salary committee for 1 year. And after that year, it was very clear that we needed something different than what we had. And we may not have known what that was, but we certainly knew it was not going down and appearing before some commission and talking about the problems of recruitment and retention and expecting that to have some impact. We believe that in order to have quality personnel, you had to be competitive in salary and benefits, and there had to be respect for the work that was done, and this was not a political relationship. This was a relationship based on right. The debate actually started and took off like a shot without us clearly understanding what was driving this. But the employees who were members of the organization at that time took it upon themselves to say, we've got some decisions to make. In order to get in the relationship we want to have, we've got to be a union, if that's what we want to be. And if we make that decision, then the question is, what union do we want to associate with? and what are we willing to pay for all of this? And that became the that debate grew out of our salary discussions with the county. After a year of discussing among all of the various groups that made up the membership, this thing went to a plebiscite. I mean, a vote of the membership on those three questions. Surprisingly, there was a positive response on the first one. Yes, we ought to be a union, given the environment that we work in, and so forth. The second question was put off to later because we didn't really know what organizations we would be a good fit with or who would have an interest in our kinds of employees. So we resolved the first. We then started to look around and to contact other unions to see what interest they may have in taking on an organization such as ours. At that time, we had about 7,500 members, including courthouse lawyers and social workers and hospital. We had a...
Take a minute, though, to just go back a little bit. You represented one of the more elite groups within the workforce for the county.
Mm-hmm.
Did the others groups in other areas take the same route that you did?
Not at that time. California is a unique state. It has very strong employee associations at the county level, and even at the state level. But we were a county. I mean, you had Los Angeles County, San Francisco City and County, San Bernardino. I mean, you had a whole host of very strong organizations whose interests at that time may not have been the same as ours. Many of the associations had a very strong policy role in the setting of pensions and pension benefits. They had a very strong role in trying to protect the integrity of the civil service system. And many of them thought we were off base because their argument was that it's an either or, either it's collective bargaining or civil service. And our argument was that they can live side by side. There are just some unique advantages to collective bargaining. So we didn't have a whole lot of allies in this, and it is true we represented, by and large, the white-collar sections of county government, although there were blue-collar membership because of the Public Works Department, but by and large it was white-collar. It was social workers. It was assistant district attorneys. It was registered. It was a whole gamut. We had laborers and truck drivers, but numerically they were a smaller piece. And it was quite a surprise to us that the issue of unionism won by such a large margin in the plebiscite. So our task then was, in light of this uniqueness, what union did we want to talk with and to talk to? Among those that were looked at, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees was the one who appeared to have the greatest likeness nationally in terms of a membership like ours. Even though we were, in those days, pretty much a blue-collar union, the issues around the protection of public sector, work, quality work, decent pay, the right to be involved in the collective bargaining, all those were issues that rang, pretty good with us. So we sort of asked the leadership to sit down and talk with us about an affiliation of our organization and AFSCME. And at that time, the AFSCME was led by a fellow by the name of Arnold Zander, who had, oddly enough, been the head of the civil service system in the state of Wisconsin. So he had a great understanding of that system. He wasn't terribly impressed with our argument about collective bargaining, but at least that system he understood. And could certainly speak at great lengths about the value of public service and the role that it it plays in the total scheme of life. So our leadership at that time made a decision that that's who we wanted to go with.
How did you go about, first of all, what other unions were considered, as you recall?
In our county, one of the strongest unions were the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union, because we had in our county we had Shell Oil, Union Oil, Standard Oil, and their power and influence with the Board of Supervisors and with the state level was considerable. We then had in our county a part of the Operating Engineers, which was a very strong union up and down the state, but had very little knowledge, both of them, very little knowledge of our pension systems and the systems of public sector, you know, wages and benefits. There was another union there, which was at that time was Building Services Union, and I think it was the local in our county was Local 302, but they were at that time strictly just that, building service workers. And one of our leadership at that time, a fellow by the name of Benjamin Russell, he and some of the others, through a process, I'm not sure how it worked, but met with the leadership of AFSCME and brought back this positive response that they would be willing to talk to us further about this. And in short order, we put this issue into some decision-making process and said, here's what we think. And since we didn't have a whole lot of alternatives, I mean, it wasn't, it's like there was a long ballot that folks, you know, we had a series of meetings and discussions. And the decision was, AFSCME is one that we ought to look at and sort of at least get engaged, if not married. So we began to participate with them, with AFSCME at that time, in a series of their programs, their conventions and regional meetings around issues of public sector workers. And finally, we said, this is where we want to be.
Did Mr. Zander come in, or any of his top officials come in to meet with you?
Yes. In those days, I'm trying to think who was at the top of the leadership then. The names escape me now, but there was a fellow by the name of Leo Kramer.
Yes.
Who was Mr. Zander's principal assistant, if not executive assistant. And then Jerry Wirth was also one of his principal people, although Jerry's role was principally in New York. But he was a top leader with Mr. Zander. And either one or both may have met with our folks at that time. I think Leo especially had a role in it. I'm not exactly sure of what it all was. But in 1956, we became a total part of the AFSCME family and remained as such as we moved toward the 60s. But our zeal for a collective bargaining and sort of the true status as unionism, as trade unionists, wasn't totally bought by Mr. Zander, although many of those who were key parts of the AFSCME family were beginning to talk in this context. And I remember specifically that Michigan, New York, Pennsylvania, certainly the city of Philadelphia, Boston, many of the cities were starting to argue for this particular right to bargain collectively, and were really unprepared to wait for all this legislative, acceptance of the idea.
What impact did you have upon California and the other counties?
It clearly began to shift. When we affiliated with AFSCME, we did so with a very clear theory that our successes in this process would be used to convince other associations of the value of affiliation. As a matter of fact, the Constitution was amended to give the president the authority to consummate affiliations where independent organizations wanted to do that. And a number of them became, as I call it, engaged. They didn't rush to affiliate, but they certainly wanted to know more about it. And we formed a number of organizations in California for the purpose of sort of gradually exposing more and more people to this issue of a trade union approach to our relationships with the counties, as opposed to the way it had been in the past. And while we didn't get an awful lot of county laws or ordinances passed, we did find a number of organizations taken more seriously for the power that they had. San Bernardino County, Los Angeles City and County. San Francisco was always a very strong county on its own. I mean, it existed by charter. So they could just shift gears and do what we were doing, as opposed to going through this formal affiliation process. I think we had a tremendous impact in raising the level of awareness of county organizations about what they could do, and ultimately, through their political strength, getting the state legislature to pass collective bargaining legislation that would allow them to do what they call meet and confer, now I think it is. So in the 60s, I think we had that impact that we've seen, you know, culminated in the 70s or the early 80s. Even at the state level, you know, state employees, the State Employee Association came in under the new law and became, in effect, a trade union with bargaining relationships with the state. But the idea nationwide took on a tremendous importance to many areas of the country. New York City, as I said, Boston, Philadelphia. Philadelphia, incidentally, was the place where the first collective bargaining agreement between a municipal union and city government ever happened, and it happened outside of the law. But what began to be very clear is that where we would organize and press for collective bargaining rights, if we were politically strong enough to do it, it made the law easier to pass, either at the city level or the county level or the state level. Example certainly is right here in the state of Michigan. In 1965, I believe it was thereabout, where we had developed strong organizations, certainly here in the city of Detroit and moving statewide, with this labor history in the state, you know, many political leaders felt that it was an acceptable idea. Might have a different wrinkle here and there because of the nature of public service, but by and large, workers were entitled to bargain collectively. You know, Ohio. I mean, the idea gained currency across the board, and at the same time, aided in our organizing efforts. In 1964, well, I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me go back a little ways. This debate, coming into the early 60s, 60, 61, 62, began to be the critical issue that confronted the membership of this union. We were an Eastern and Midwest union. Those organizations that were a part of our early history were totally committed to civil service and merit systems. New places that were organized and were totally committed to a collective bargaining relationship, not suggesting that you do away with the civil service and merit systems, but this would be the key process. And Mr. Zander and some of his followers felt differently. And I think it was around this issue that he and Jerry Wirth found their largest area of disagreement. Because Jerry was an old, you know, social activist and certainly a strong trade unionist, and he believed that in the fundamental right of workers to organize and bargain collectively, irrespective of whether they were public or private. And That debate consumed the union. I mean, it was the principal criteria that defined who you were. And in the election of, in the convention, I should say, of 1962, while I wasn't there, I'm told that issue was the sort of the central issue to define the two different candidates. By 62, Jerry had broken or was breaking with Zander and forming another organization called the Committee on Union Responsibility, CUR. And the 62 convention was in Philadelphia. And it was very clear that the overwhelming majority of the leadership was beginning to believe in the debate itself that collective bargaining rights were or should be inherent the hours. And Mr. Zander and his forces, as a matter of fact, they brought Walter Reuther in to speak to that convention, and it was low-level chaos. But the forces for collective bargaining clearly prevailed. And whether Mr. Zander recognized it or not, I mean, the union turned around that convention. So at the end of it, the issue was not who you're for, but what are you for?
He tried, as you may recall, to confuse the issue by having the per capita increase is the main issue.
Yeah.
And that's what Walter Reuther spoke on behalf of. But go back a little bit. From the time that this principle was approved in California and the vote was taken, the plebiscite was taken on behalf of affiliation with the union, what was your role?
I was just a rank and filer at the time, and active rank and filer, but I didn't hold an office in the union at that time. I was, as I say, representing the materials and research laboratory in the union's operation. And I guess I was beginning to learn more and more about not just how the organization worked, but really what the role of a union ought to be. I had, as I said, served as salary representative of, or a member of the salary committee, so I had some clarity about how that worked. But I really didn't know a whole lot about, you know, grievance mechanisms and arbitration systems, because we didn't have any, there was no role for it in our county, but we did have some who had served in these areas before. And so it was a learning experience for me and for a lot of other folks. But our organization was becoming more and more important in the whole scheme of things as the state was concerned, because we were clearly advocates for a new relationship between worker organizations and their employers. So there were a lot of employee independent associations who were urging us on and admired what we were doing. There were a lot of them who was very concerned about what the long-range implications of this were, because many of them were politically connected, had great strength in Sacramento and in their counties. And, you know, the unanswered question was, how does this disturb those relationships? And so my role was simply keeping our people informed as to what the organization was doing and how it was going, and keep them aware of what the concerns of the engineering, you know, sector was. I later became an officer in the organization around 63, somewhere in there.
How did that come about?
Each of the major departments who were active in the organization had the chance to recommend or nominate people for office or to the executive board. And I was nominated to the board by the Public Works Department. And subsequently from the board became an officer. And that was a membership-wide election process where the you know, all of the departments vote. I mean, I'm not altogether sure you could say it was a true election, because by the time the powers to be had decided who was going to be a part of the process, you know, everybody was pretty much assured of not having any competition, you know, for the position you were being put up for.
But this was the beginning of your career.
Yeah,
In the politics of a union.
Yeah,
running for office and being elected.
Yeah. Once on the board, there were committees and areas of responsibility that were assigned to you either by the officers or by the board itself. And so I took on a number because I thought it was terribly interesting work, for one thing. But I continued the role as salary, as chair of the salary committee for our department, and began to learn a lot more about the politics of the county. You know, how things get done, you know, how to organize and mobilize around issues in order to get the political support from the member of the Board of Supervisors, how to develop campaigns in your community. Our county seat was in the central part of the county. Where I lived was in the western part of the county. So we began to develop a little bit of community, you know, organizational support. Began to get engaged a little bit in the electoral politics, both in our city and for county. Each member of the Board of Supervisors represented a sector of the county. And we began to understand that to the extent you can help or hurt, I mean, you have influence. And our membership was a county-wide membership. And one of the unique things about public sector employees, and particularly white collar, is that if you convince them to become politically active, then the issues of organization and mobilization and strategies, you know, they take ownership and play a big role in trying to carry out plans and programs that the organization approved. So we were able to get engaged in that early on. And in my town, which was Richmond, which was, I think at that time, the largest city in the county, we became quite active and quite involved and around not just bread and butter issues, but other social issues that many of us thought were important that an organization engaged in.
Also, things going on at this time, statewide in the political system and national.
Mm-hmm.
Kennedy coming in
right
early in the 1960s.
Right.
What offices did you get involved in within the union?
I became president of the local. I mean, when we affiliated, we were assigned the number local 1675 from the national union. We maintained our old number, Contra Costa County employees. I became president, I think, around 63 or 64. And we were, as most county organizations, after we went through the election, I think it's important to note that not everybody agreed with this. I mean, we won the vote, but we didn't win the hearts of everybody. We lost about 1,500 members as a result of this direction. Folks who just figured that they their careers didn't dovetail with where we were trying to go. But we had such an extensive discussion and debate about it that it was not a surprise to anybody. We didn't lose as many as we thought we would lose. So we had, oddly enough, a very tight-knit, you know, very ideologically focused group of members. I mean, across all sectors of county employment. Those that stayed knew why they were staying. They knew what the sort of philosophical outlook of the leadership in the organization was. So they weren't surprised by anything. I mean, they knew that we would be a group that was concerned about social rights, civil rights, human rights, because that was a part of the debate. They knew we would be politically active and would engage the political leadership of the county on a whole series of issues, majority of which related to, you know, workplace stuff, but others that were not. I mean, we had social workers whose concerns for their clients was not just the implementation of the rules, but how do we make the system better? We had hospital workers who thought that while the care was good, can it be better? I mean, so we went through this debate, and everyone who stayed knew this was the agenda.
Were there any specific groups that chose not to? Were those that you said didn't buy into the new plan, the 1,500? Or did they represent?
Not an organized group. No. The largest, I guess, segment that we lost was from the sort of the legal side of the county employment, the district attorney's office, right, and some of the regulatory agencies, which were highly professional. An employee association has everybody in, you know, from the department heads on down. But when this decision was made, you know, you had the department head and principal department, you know, administrative staff. Some of them just took a hike. It probably wound up being good for us, because as we moved towards this whole bargaining process, who's in, who's out, we didn't have to go through all of that.
When you started the union, what happened to the existing employees association county that?
It became the union, as I say. They just simply
didn't continue then.
How best to put it? The employee association became the union.
Right.
We didn't go out of business or anything like that.
Well, I wondered, the ones that chose not to go into that system, they represented it all of
no,
the out there.
No, they were just out. Right, right.
Perhaps this is a good time, you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's go back to 1963, if we can. You had mentioned earlier that of the struggle going on nationally between a group opposing Zander and his approach,
mm-hmm,
and others led by Joe Ames, mm-hmm, Hastings,
right,
Father Blatz, and
right,
Jerry Wirth, and the like.
Right.
I don't know others, but there are a long list of them in that category. What was your position as president of the local by this time?
I think I was either vice president or I must have been vice president at
but
that time.
But you were active in the leadership.
Yeah, in the leadership, yeah.
And
yeah.
How did you become aware of this struggle? Was this well known, and what pressure
after
you
the,
upon your union?
After 1962, it was very clear there were two different trains of thought in the union as to what direction we should be going. And bear in mind, we were not a massive union in those days, but we were trying to win the hearts and minds of public sector workers. So the debate was rather clear. I mean, and the core forces certainly reflected our view, our being Contra Costa County, our view of what kind of relationship and philosophy the organization ought to have. And I became a part of that debate. We had leadership in the union, like fellows by the name of Ben Russell and Ruby Wicker, and people from up and down the state who had begun to say, yeah, we think we're right. This is the direction to be going. So we were not locked in with supporters or operatives, but we certainly were philosophically in tune. And I think what tipped our union one way or the other, we were still open enough to have a debate and discussion about this. And I distinctly remember a meeting that we held at the Claremont Hotel. And we invited Mr. Zander, this was in 63 or early 64, out to talk about his view. I think it was a open and honest invitation, not a sandbagging job or nothing like that. So he came out, and I mean, it was a magnificent show. But at the end of the show, his staff, I don't know if you've ever been to the Claremont Hotel, but in the ballroom there's a series of windows that face the bay. And they let the Venetian blinds down, and on the blinds were taped this banner that said, Contra Costa County loves Arnold Zander. And what had been a friendly gathering up to then turned into absolute chaos, because not only did we not any longer trust the national leadership, we just fundamentally believed that it was had no clear understanding of what we were trying to do. And so we became WRF supporters almost overnight.
And it was that use of the banners that crystallized the opposition to him?
Yeah, yeah. We had lots of first-level leadership at this meeting, but an awful lot of second- and third-level leadership who may not have been convinced one way or the other as to the personalities, but they certainly saw that as misusing, you know, the presence and the invitation. And so we just became an active part of the opposition. We became a leading part of what was called the Bear Flag Caucus. And we then began to make contact up and down the state and promote the core line. I had never met Mr. WRF at that point in time. I had, I believe, been in the presence of Bob Hastings or Al Billick, some of the others who were actively engaged in the campaign effort. I didn't meet Mr. WRF until probably at the 1964 convention. And I, like many others, you know, was just sort of captivated by, you know, his ideas and insights, because many of them were identical to what we had believed we ought to be about as a part of this issue of affiliations debate that we had. But we became part of the loyal opposition, and as the Zander crowd called us the forces of darkness.
Did you go to the 1964 convention?
Yes, yes.
Was that the first one?
That was my first convention.
First convention.
And I believe, and I'd really have to check, I believe I was president, either president or first vice president by that time, because I was chair of our caucus, and I think the two things sort of went together. But the 64 convention, as if you've obviously checked the records, was a turning point in the life of the union. The election was a very close election, very, very hotly contested. And I think the fact that the International had a policy of staff, you know, carrying the credentials for local unions who were unrepresented in the convention, and carrying the credentials of some who were represented in the convention, you know, the contest to, again, change the minds of people was one that that we sort of really relished, because we were not talking about personality, we were talking about ideas. And in the end, people began to ask for their voting credentials back from the staff. I mean, I'm told, and I didn't conduct a count, but I'm told at least 65% to 67% of the votes in the convention were in the control of staff people at the beginning of the convention. And this was International staff people. So there was a real, you know, revolution took place among the delegates to the convention.
Where was the convention held?
In Denver, Colorado.
Denver, Colorado. Uh-huh. And what was it like for you, if indeed this was your first convention, that you were aware beforehand, I'm sure, that these issues were going to be brought up?
I wasn't quite sure what I was in and what role I was playing, because I'd never been to one of these before, and certainly a national convention for somebody like myself was pretty heady stuff, you know what I mean? So I arrived very unsure, other than what our basic political position was, unsure of how to go about advancing this. And our small delegation from our local who went, we were very clear on what roles we were going to try and play. One of our folks was on credentials. Somebody else was on legislative committees. And we were going to try and just carry out what we were asked to do. I remember, and I've said it often to this lady, just going into the hotel, I met a lady from New York, a lady by the name of Miss Carrie, can't remember her last name, but the first name was Carrie. She was a delegate, and I was lamenting the fact that I really wasn't quite clear what this was all about, but we were going to try and win. And she sort of gave some sage advice, and that was to be clear on what you believe in and go out and try and convince other folks to believe the same thing. I didn't put much stock in what it meant, but for us, a delegation of about five people, we became quite actively engaged in the workings of the convention, both the goods and the bads and the uglies. I mean, we were pretty political, and we, like I guess other people, did things that you probably would rather not have talk about. But I mean, they say all is fair in love and war and union politics, and I think this is probably true there. But we had a serious discussion at that convention. We managed to force sort of a candidates' debate among the delegates at that convention, and I think